Welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast, presented by Exo Mountain Gear. This podcast and the gear that we produce at Exo Mountain Gear share the same purpose: to make you a more capable, confident, and successful backcountry hunter. This show is all about providing you with valuable information from experienced hunters. To learn more about the podcast or about our backcountry hunting packs, visit exomountaingear.com. Well, we're back. September's over. We're into October and excited to get back to releasing new episodes for you guys. If you caught the Monday Minute just a few days ago, you kind of heard what Steve and I were up to in September, and there's much more to come on that. We want to hear about your September. We mentioned it in that episode. I'll mention it again. If you have any stories, photos, highs, lows, stuff to share, shoot us an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com. It's been fun to hear from some of you already. It's pretty crazy to hear that the podcast has helped some of you guys fill tags, and I know that that's not me for sure. It's not really Steve. It's more speaking to our guests and the information that they provide, but it's super cool to hear how the podcast has helped some of you guys have adventures, find success, fill tags, fill the freezer, all that. So definitely let us know if you haven't already about your season. In this episode, getting back to kind of a regularly scheduled program, we have an interview with Troy from Benchmade Knives. So we discuss really a traditional knife, meaning like a fixed blade or a folder, versus a replaceable blade knife. So comparing, you know, a Benchmade type of knife versus something like a Havilon or an Outdoor Edge or many of the other replaceables, discussing the pros and cons of those two approaches, and then getting into specifics if you are going to choose a fixed blade or a folding knife, what to look for in terms of steel and size and shape and all those different attributes that kind of make the perfect hunting knife. Troy certainly knows this stuff. It was super fun to talk to him. We talk at a high level. We talk somewhat about Benchmade models specifically. You know, I've been using Benchmade knives for close to 10 years now, both for hunting as well as everyday carry. Had a chance to test some of their latest models this September. They definitely have a really, really good thing going. Good quality knives coming out of the USA. So if you're interested, you know, go check them out, Benchmade Knives. But even if you're not interested in Benchmade specifically, just want to learn more about knife anatomy, blade, steel, usage, sharpening, all that good stuff, definitely check this out. All right, I've rambled long enough. You can tell I haven't done this in a while. Let's get on to this interview with Troy from Benchmade Knives. Troy, welcome to the Hunt Backcountry podcast. Thanks for joining us, bud.
Anytime. Thanks, Mark. Good to be here.
Yeah. Steve, how's it going, man?
Good. Good. Really excited to talk to Troy and learn about knives and steels and everything that goes into making a quality knife, you know, separating it from the kind of the cheaper stuff out there.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be interesting. I'm totally excited to have that knife conversation, but I know that some of what we'll get into in steel conversation will help kind of the broadhead questions we've had as well, because we've had questions on steels and broadheads and S30V from Solid, and so we'll dive into a little bit of the steel discussion as well. But Troy, before we get there, man, go ahead and introduce yourself in terms of personal, professional background, context with Benchmade, all that good stuff.
Sure. So I grew up on the East Coast. Been hunting whitetail and turkey my whole life. And once college was over, I knew I wanted to be in the outdoor industry. So Oregon's kind of ground zero, especially Portland. Didn't necessarily know what company I wanted to be with or what I wanted to do, but packed up the truck and the dog and the lady, and we headed west. So my family's originally from the Northwest, so I knew this was kind of the point I wanted to be at. And in my time out here, jumped on with Benchmade. We're in Oregon City, Oregon, just outside of Portland. So we've got a whole bunch of knife manufacturers here in this area. We've got like a 15 square mile radius that's got quite a few heavy hitters for the knife industry. So I am our trade marketing coordinator. I do the logistics and planning for a lot of our trade shows. Our company does about 60 trade shows a year. So luckily I don't travel to all of them, but I make it to a pretty decent amount. of those trade shows. So it's been a fun ride, great company to work for, and just super grateful to be here.
Yeah. Is there a reason historically kind of for these knife companies to settle up in that area, or is it just kind of happen out that way?
Yeah, it's so Oregon's got very lax laws and legislation in regards to specific types of knives that you can carry and use as a just general civilian. A lot of states break down what you can use and carry on a daily basis due to your like employment as either active duty military or public safety or fire. So here in Oregon, you as a civilian, you can carry switchblade knives, you can carry butterfly knives, kind of whatever you want. So a big part of that is we as a company can kind of build and make what we want to play with ourselves and not have to worry about repercussions from the law in that regards.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so we had started originally in California about 30 years ago, and those we started to see those laws changing. There had already been a handful of manufacturers up here, so our CEO and founder, Les Diasis, decided to pick up the business and move it up here to Oregon.
Wow. Good old California for you.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if I'd enjoy my job as much living down there, but I get to hunt and fish 15, 20 minutes from the office, and it's a cool area. I really like being up here.
Awesome. So we're going to dive into quite a bit in terms of understanding knives and selecting knives and cover some ground, but I would just love to start with a question that I know many guys listening to this are going to face, and I'd just love to chat a bit about, you know, the replaceable blade knives that we've seen in the hunting industry over the past handful of years with Havilons and all that good stuff, and then compare that to something like a more, I'll say for this point, traditional knife in terms of a standard folder or fixed blade, something that you'd see from Benchmade. So help us understand kind of the pros and cons of choosing between those two broad categories of knives.
Sure. The replaceable blades have obviously gotten huge. For a long time, your traditional steels from just a standard knife didn't have too much variance to them, so you didn't see this array or spectrum of different performance levels from steel. And so after a while, people had kind of gotten sick of sharpening the same knife while skinning the same animal and putting a little bit more work into it than was necessary. And so you started seeing companies come out with these replaceable blades that had just a basic surgical steel, very thin blade that you're able to pop off the handle of a knife, put it in the cartridge, store it away, and pop out a new one. So you cut down the sharpening or the need for sharpening immensely, and you can just kind of stay razor sharp and absolutely run through whatever you're working on that whatever you're working with. So whether it be an animal or you see like box cutters and stuff like that are kind of the original design of a replaceable blade. And so steels have kind of caught up since then, and you start seeing very specialized steels geared towards a specific application. And so there's kind of this teeter-totter effect between your standard kind of run-of-the-mill fixed blades and the popularity of the replaceable blade here going back and forth.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, those replaceable blades are clearly sharp. Like, there's no disputing that, but it's almost scary how sharp they are. And then when I get in the field and, you know, hands get wet, and it every time it comes to replace one of those things, I realize how dangerous that actually is, especially on a Havilon. I know the Outdoor Edge system's kind of improved on that, and there's others out there, but have you used Havilons quite a bit? It's like, man, every time I go to do that, I realize just how quick something could get nasty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's. I start sweating when friends are just struggling with those things, trying to pop the blade in or out. When you're 8-9 miles from the truck, the last thing you want to do is service yourself and maybe have to cut a hunt short or go back to the truck and get help. And that can happen very quickly, especially as you start working into colder climates or you're tired, it's getting dark. So some of the downsides to those replaceable blades, like you said, are the safety of them overall and popping that blade in and out. And then it's such a thin steel that it's very easy. I'm sure you guys have had issues with it yourselves, but snapping that blade off in the meat, and then you're kind of stuck like searching for this sharp half of a blade somewhere in a bloody carcass, essentially. And so those situations can get dangerous very quickly. And again, I mean, the last thing you want to be concerned about is the safety of your hands as you're skinning an animal there.
Yeah, there's so much to it for sure. Let's go ahead and let's dive into the steel talk. I was going to save it for later, but now I'm just so curious after what you mentioned previously. I guess help us begin to understand. You'd mentioned historically steels were a certain way, but then steel technology has caught up. And I know that part of that has been with the more modern super steels and this idea of powdered steels. Walk us through some of that and help us understand, like, what is a powdered steel? What makes these modern steels different than what we've had for, you know, ages and ages?
Sure. So I'll try to keep it pretty simple. It's really easy to nerd out on this topic. But traditionally, your steels were cast from a large ingot of alloying compounds or elements and carbides. There's a very long cooling process that's involved in that traditional style of steel. And so during that cooling process, it allows those carbides and alloying elements to segregate as they settle. And so you might get one spot of a large piece of steel that's got a little bit more of something than another. And so you have essentially inconsistencies throughout that entire chunk or block of steel. And so over time, you might notice on the same knife that one spot wears a little bit quicker than others, or you're just sharpening more than you feel like you need to on that specific blade. And so as technology has progressed into our powdered steels now, you see a much more even dispersion of those alloys and carbides that are doing a majority of the work for you. They're very evenly spaced because that powdered process is such a quick cooling speed. So it doesn't let stuff kind of settle and shift out towards the corners or the ends of the billet. It's all right there and solidified very quickly. So on any given knife, you're nowadays kind of going to range from a Rockwell hardness of like 58 to 61 HRC is the standardized measurement there. Those individual carbides that make up the entirety of that blade run anywhere from like 80 to 82 HRC. And so they're, if you're looking at it under a microscope, they're very small dots that you can see under that microscope. And those are the guys that are essentially like microscopic serrations. They're essentially taking the majority of the abrasion for the blade, and you're kind of wearing at those carbides. So if you were to look at a traditional steel blade versus a powdered steel blade, the absolute sharpened edge, that point there, is actually going to be straighter on some of this traditional blades with less evenly dispersed carbides, less of those molecules blocked up against that sharpened edge. And the powdered blade is almost going to squiggle and wave itself around those carbides to essentially divert that edge around and keep those carbides intact. If you were using a very abrasive material to sharpen that edge, you would run the risk of knocking those carbides off the sharpened edge itself. And you actually want to keep those guys there. They're kind of your little hitman army on the sharpened edge there, trying to take the majority of the bite for the knife.
I don't want to forget to ask about sharpening then, so make sure we don't forget to come back to that. But you mentioned earlier edge retention, and that's obviously something that's a great benefit to these more modern steels. And as you mentioned, you know, getting to the point where you don't have to stop and sharpen as you're breaking down game. With these modern steels and the edge retention that they have, are we talking possible to go ahead and, you know, break down, say, an entire elk without touching it up? Or is it just a really simple touch up? Like, what's practical use in the field from these modern steels?
That's a great question. So a lot of what you see nowadays is CPM S30V. That's a steel that we use almost exclusively on our hunt line. As of this past year, we introduced kind of its big brother S90V to the hunt series just on one specific knife. But in the field, something like S30V is going to be something that you could essentially break down an entire elk with it. I like to keep my knives from getting too dull. And so as soon as I start feeling a little bit of resistance, I don't go through a full spectrum of sharpening, but something like a WorkSharp field sharpener has ceramic surfaces, diamond surfaces, and a leather strop. So I'll pass my knife on that diamond for about 15, 20 seconds and then flip it back over to the leather and hone that edge. So elapsed time, you're looking at 30, 40 seconds, and you can either get back to skinning that animal out or move on to the next one. So theoretically, depending on how careful you are about hitting bone or rough material, you could get through an entire, let's say, bull elk with an S30V blade.
Kind of comes back to this whole paradigm of it's easier to stay in shape than get in shape.
Exactly.
And I'm thinking it's the same way with sharpness, right? Like it's easier just to kind of do quick touch-ups and keep it sharp than it is to let it get incredibly dull and then make it sharp. Is that what we're getting at?
You're spot on. That's exactly right. So you're not spending an immense amount of time on that sharpening system. It's just quick passes, staying on top of that edge retention and that sharpened edge itself. And you're not doing more work than you have to at the end of the day.
Okay. So you mentioned the S30V and the S90V. Just to geek out a little bit, what are the differences there? Because you mentioned the S90V just expanded into the hunt line and it's only on one mm-hmm. model. So what are the benefits or pros and cons of choosing the S30 versus S90?
So they're very similar. They're premium stainless steels. So you're going to see very low. You're not going to see much of a need for fighting against corrosion. Great for us here in Oregon. I feel like my knives are wet more times than they're dry, with the exception of archery season. We're still usually pretty warm and dry around that time of year. But if you guys are out towards the coast or just humid environments in general, a lot of the south can run into that, or just east of the Mississippi, you're not going to worry about that knife pitting or corroding out on you nearly as fast with either S30V or S90V. So that's a great characteristic of both of those steel types. They're very similar in that regard, but where you see S90V kind of stray away is in terms of edge retention. So it's a harder steel by nature. It's going to hold that edge much longer. It's going to be much more difficult to sharpen if you were to really let this knife go down the road of being dull. But at the same time, since both steels are very hard, they don't have the toughness that you would see out of a very high carbon steel, something like M4 that we would put on like a machete, something that you can just hack away with and not worry about hitting trees or limbs, or even if you get a bite at the ground real fast. S90V and S30V, you would run the risk of chipping that blade essentially because it is such a high performance edge retaining steel.
Yeah, that's a good point that I don't know that folks realize, is the hardness is good and the edge retention is good, but once it's almost paradoxical until you start to really think about it being a fine edge, but the harder something gets, it actually becomes more brittle in a sense, as you just mentioned, to chipping and things like that.
Exactly. So you see fillet knives are a much softer steel to allow that blade to flex. You're not going to get any flex out of one of our like skinning knives or some of our other dressing and gutting knives that we make.
So you mentioned something like a WorkSharp field sharpener's a good recommendation for keeping care in the field. Any other particular tips or things we should know about taking a traditional knife, a non-replaceable blade, to the knife for field use?
That's pretty much it. Especially if you're one to carry fixed blades more than a folding mechanism, they're so rudimentary off their design. There's not much there that you need to worry about. A lot of the handle materials that we use are incredibly durable, so they don't require oiling or cleaning or upkeep during the actual season. A lot of my knives I'll wash in the creek at the most, if I have the luxury of having running water somewhere close by. But for the most part, it's just that diamond, ceramic, or leather, and you're good to go for a season.
And then obviously something, because we talked about these modern steels and they're harder, getting into the diamond and ceramics is going to be more important versus if somebody has like an old sharpener from a high carbon knife of just like a stone, that's not going to work well on these modern steels, right?
Correct. Yep. The times have changed with knife steels, so it's time to update our sharpening systems as well. You, like my grandfather loves his whetstone or an Arkansas stone, something very soft that can put a great edge on a conventional steel. But when it's you start working into these super steels, you're going to need something that's going to hold up against that material and actually do you good instead of wasting your time as you sit there for 30, 40 minutes trying to get a basic edge on a knife.
So I've been using Benchmade knives for a long time, not just for hunting, but just everyday carry and all kinds of things, probably close to 10 years at this point at least. And something I've taken advantage of a fair amount with my Benchmade knives is your Life Sharp service.
Yeah.
First, I guess, tell people about what that is if they don't know. But I'm just curious, how do you guys actually sharpen knives? What process do you use when those Benchmade knives are sent back to the factory for service?
Sure. That's a great question. So our Life Sharp program, it comes complimentary with any knife you get from us. We're pretty lax about it. So if you found one sitting on the side of the road or at a trailhead and you couldn't find the original owner, you could essentially send that thing into us just as if you're the original owner. And we'll go through what we call the Benchmade spa treatment. So folding knives, we're going to crack that thing open, throw it in a sonic cleaning bath, just like you would use to clean brass if you do any reloading. We'll throw all the components in that bath, soak it up, get the grit and grime out of there. And then depending on the technicality of your mechanism, we'll rebuild your spring structure if you've got an assisted or an automatic knife. Our access lock uses springs as well, so we'll replace those whether you need them or not. New hardware all across the board, and then you're going to get cleaned, oiled, tuned, and sharpened back to our factory standard, all free of charge. So essentially, the customer would pay shipping to our factory here in Oregon. We'd take care of the rest for them and send that knife back.
Yeah, I pretty much have done that about once a year on my everyday carry. I'm not sure if there's supposed to be some sort of limit to that, but I pretty much will like pick at one point through the year and like, I'm going to go get this baby tuned.
Yeah. There's no limit to it. You can send knives in as frequently or as infrequently as you would like, whatever floats your boat. So, it's a great program. Obviously we know that these customers spend a great deal of money on our knives. Our knives aren't cheap. And so we want to provide a service that reflects that cost. And we're a very customer centric organization and business. We take that very seriously. So, we like to bend over backwards as best as we can to make sure that these people are really enjoying our product and that our product is living up to its reputation.
Can you go back and do Rockwell hardness? Just kind of define that. I think we kind of skipped over it pretty fast.
Sure.
Yeah, pretty important part of it, right?
There is. So there's a standardized measurement for hardness of any given steel, and it's called your Rockwell hardness. You'll see the unit of measurement designated as HRC. And like I said, you'll see a lot of blade steels nowadays kind of fluctuating between that like 58 to 60 or 61 HRC. That's going to be something like your S30V. S90V goes above that. You're at like 62 to 64 HRC on those knives. And so like we had said earlier, you're kind of looking at give and take there. The higher you go that HRC, the harder that steel is, but it'll essentially become more brittle at that point. So you need to be careful about what kind of material that knife sees.
For comparison's sake, what's like a cheap knife? I'm getting like a 440 steel or something like that. Where's that rate on the Rockwell hardness?
It'll vary from manufacturer to manufacturer. Some of it comes from the heat treatment process of the steel itself. So for us here at Benchmade, 440C is actually at the same Rockwell hardness as S30V, 58 to 60.
Oh, wow.
So it seems counterintuitive, but honestly, I think a lot of Rockwell hardness is split in hairs. There are so many other alloying elements that go into a steel that give it its specialized characteristics. HRC and Rockwell is really that standardized measurement for a lot of us as we're doing our testing and kind of a tip of the hat to the heat treatment process.
Okay.
Can you talk about the heat treatments a bit? I know that's a factor in, you know, taking this steel, and it's not just, okay, it's S30V, but how it's produced and how it's treated And then I've seen chatter of like, you know, Benchmade's heat treat versus somebody else's heat treat. How much of that process is a factor? Is there something that you guys do differently at Benchmade or do something a very certain way for a certain reason in the heat treatment process?
You know, I'm not sure if there's anything that makes us unique about our heat treatment process compared to other manufacturers. I've seen the chatter too, and I don't know if it's more a factor of the echo chamber of online forums and social media or if there really is some truth behind it. But depending on that steel type, we obviously will run different temperatures for that heat treatment process to kind of cater to the natural elements and components of that steel. We basically just want to get that steel to its highest performing level, and that heat treatment is certainly a part of that process. You're kind of finalizing that molecular bond. So a lot of what you see in like the powdering metals is what you're trying to do is eliminate the gaps or pores between molecules that create that very even dispersion of your carbides and alloying elements. So that the heat treatment is kind of the finishing touch on that. And once you've set your bevel grinds and surface ground the blade itself from its just basic rudimentary flat form, that final state in, so that we can go in and either coat it or with like a ceramic Cerakote or diamond like carbon coatings, depending on the usage, or just leaving it sat silver blade. And that's when you can go in and put your edge on it or laser mark it, whatever you need to do.
Cool. Anything else on steel, Steve, that we want to cover in that kind of topic there?
I don't think so. Yeah, I think we've kind of hit it pretty well. I was just super curious. You know, there's so many steels out there, and the answer is probably you guys just test it all. And, you know, like what separates all the different steels, and we've kind of talked about it. So,
yeah. I think right now we're running 11 production steels across the board. And obviously we've got tricks up our sleeve playing with other steel that some other manufacturers might already be well down the road in production with. They're new to us. And then, some steels that are just kind of new in general to the industry. So it's cool to have the flexibility to play with a lot of those different materials. Our test lab is such a cool place to be. We have a couple different machines that basically these guys break knives for a living. So I think that's one of the coolest jobs here. You can get side tension tests to see how much weight a knife can take on the handle while the blade's clamped into a vise before it gives. There's a cutting machine that shows or graphs edge retention. It essentially clamps that knife at a 45 degree angle and swings it through an abraded phone book paper. And as it cuts through that phone book paper at an angle every time, we have a line graph running showing how long that edge is holding. And you can kind of start to compare and contrast steels at that point. And that's when we figured out that the S90V might be something that we should think about for the Hunt series.
Interesting. Huh. Yeah, that would be fun.
I want to talk more about specific models later, but just real quick, what is the one model that you mentioned is in the Hunt line with the S90V steel?
So that's our Altitude, 15200. We do it in an orange Cerakoted blade and then a black diamond-like carbon coating. So they're very similar coatings, just aesthetically. A big difference for something like diamond-like carbon is that it's very low in reflectivity. So you would see it traditionally in like the military industry for firearm coatings or knife coatings themselves. You're not going to get that shine or glint out of the blade in the sun. So for a military purpose, they didn't want to give away a position to airstrike or anybody sitting up on a hill watching that area. You're not going to have this shiny black blade kind of glinting off in the sun, possibly giving away a location. It's also very durable. So you're going to see improved scratch resistance and wear out of something like a diamond-like carbon or PVD coated versus a ceramic Cerakote. It's got its pros and its cons. Bright day in the field, your adrenaline's rolling, you just harvested an animal and you set that thing down in the grass. That might be a little tougher to find, obviously, than a bright orange ceramic coated blade laying there. So depending on your need or your usage, you kind of go one color or the other.
Yeah, we'll come back and talk more about that for sure. Let's keep trucking on like these high level categories, I would love to talk about just fixed versus folding. Obviously a basic concept. One of these things that I think, again, in the past, to think of using a folding knife in a hunting situation was not really considered. But yeah, with some of the locking mechanisms that you guys have, especially like these folders, totally not your grandpa's case knife, you know, in terms of a folder. Exactly. So help us understand choosing fixed versus folding, and then something like the Benchmade Access Lock, how that works, and then how reliable that is.
Sure. So a lot of what boils down in fixed versus folding is personal preference. I personally carry fixed for all of my field dressing. I will carry a very slim, lightweight folder on my person when I'm backcountry hunting, or even just hunting out of the truck on the Oregon coast here, walking logging roads and stuff like that. So I'll use my folding pocket knife for cutting food, cutting open like freeze-dried food bags and stuff like that. And then the folding or the fixed blade knives are going to be exclusively for skinning and dressing that animal. I try to keep them kind of separate but equal there. So the fixed blades for me, I like them in the field because they're very low maintenance. Like we touched on earlier, you have that full solid tang of steel running from the tip of the blade point back to the tip of your handle. So rigidity and strength are definitely an upside to that type of design. And especially for large game animals, you get a lot of like cartilage and fat and gristle that will build up inside the mechanisms of a folding knife. And without completely disassembling that thing in the field, it can be very tough to get that mechanism cleaned out for the rest of your trip. So I had kind of given up on the folding blades in that regards, and have just stuck pretty exclusively to a fix. But again, that's just my opinion.
And then can you help explain the access lock? Because if guys are interested in a folder for, whether that's for hunting or just general use, I don't know. Like, it's one of these things, I don't want to make it sound like a commercial, but for me, sure, the access lock was a total game changer when I discovered it years ago.
Yeah, that's, we've kind of prided ourselves as a company for a long time in pioneering a lot of different technologies. And I think that's most evident with the access lock. For a long time, knife manufacturers had built knives that catered heavily towards the right-handed user. And the reality is there's a lot of left-handed users in the world. So having to switch up hands or kind of reach around the knife to disengage something like a liner lock for a left-handed user is uncomfortable, and it can also get dangerous. So the access lock is essentially a stud that travels through both sides of the handle and allows both a right and left-handed user to deploy and close that blade just as easily, no matter which hand it's in. A lot of our folding knives are absolutely symmetrical. So it comes out of the factory with the clip positioned to accommodate a right-handed user, but you could take a Torx bit, pop that clip off, swap it over to the other side if you're a lefty, and throw it in that other pocket and have absolutely zero limitation for deployment or disengagement. You see that very important with like military and law enforcement as well. These guys that might have a pistol on one side of their body and need something on their weak side, so their left or right hand side there, that they can pull out if things are getting down to the wire and have a knife ready to rock that they're not fumbling around for a mechanism on.
Let's talk about blade geometry a bit in terms of design, size. Before we get into the actual blade shapes of, you know, drop point versus clip point, help us understand choosing something in terms of blade thickness and then just overall blade size in terms of cutting edge and that type of size.
Sure.
What makes a good thickness? Because obviously there's pros and cons to going thick versus thin. Help us understand mm-hmm. that from a hunting perspective, and then also just general blade size in terms of the cutting length.
Sure. So thickness, you're going to see like a fillet knife, for example, very thin blade, something that provides very minimal resistance as you're moving through that medium. And so on a lot of our hunting blades, you'll see those knives and spines run just a little bit thinner than something you would use for like camping or just a utility style fixed blade. You're decreasing the surface area of contact that meat's pushing against as you work your way through your animal. And so there's a whole slew of different styles of grinds and applications for those types of grinds and beveling. But we keep it pretty simple across the board of our hunt category. So you might see what some people call a saber grind, where that secondary bevel starts like halfway through the blade itself. And then some that start all the way up towards the spine and essentially continue down into your sharpened edge there. So our Steep Country is a great example. It's a great slicing knife. It's got a little bit of a thicker spine, but that bevel travels almost all the way from the top of the spine of the knife down to that sharpened edge. So that's going to be something that you look for when it comes down to butchering the meat itself. Either if you're going to take it to be processed or you process it yourself, that's going to be a great slicing blade. Something like a skinning knife is going to have that half bevel that stops about halfway through the blade itself. And that's going to help push out and provide that resistance or that surface area that you need to alleviate some of the pressure you're taking on the sharpened edge itself, and helps kind of kick that material out of the way as you move through it very easily.
Then what about cutting the length? So the actual cutting surface and choosing blade length for a hunting scenario.
A lot of hunting knives you see, you don't want like an 8-inch kind of Crocodile Dundee style knife for a lot of what we do. A lot of the cutting has become very precision now, and so you want a knife that's manageable. You'll see that textured jimping out towards the spine of the knife on a lot of blades that provide a contact point for your thumb or your index finger to keep from slipping off when bloody or wet. And so some knives, you'll see that even further out towards the tip of the knife itself, that jimping. And that allows you to walk that finger out very carefully and make precise cuts as you work around areas like the intestine itself, something that you essentially don't want to puncture. You've seen there's old style skinning knives and even some current models that have a plastic ball out towards the tip there to keep you from puncturing things like the intestine and ruining that meat in that area. So you want to keep it, a lot of our blades are right around like 3.5-4 inches on blade length. There's really not many hands out there that are going to be too small or too large for that specific blade. You essentially want control is what I'm getting at.
And then let's go ahead and dive into the blade shapes, the actual curve, if you will, just to use layman's terms of how that cutting surface is aligned on the blade. First, before we get into the specifics, what is belly? Because that's a term that's thrown out a lot, and I don't know that's fully understood, and it clearly relates to the use of knives in terms of hunting when it comes to skinning especially. So help us understand what is belly if guys hear that term and aren't familiar with it.
Sure. So the belly is essentially a curvature or deviation in the sharpened edge itself that is bulbous. It works out and away and kind of back up towards the tip. So it creates this essential gut or belly in the blade itself. And what you're doing is increasing the surface area of the sharpened edge without increasing the overall length of the knife. And so being able to provide these, because of that curvature, you essentially have increased surface area for cut angles. And so you can slide that skin or that hide or that meat through that curved point of the blade and up into the belly. And it's almost aiding in you cutting through that material without straining on the hand nearly as much as you need it to. And it keeps that blade from being uncommonly or unnecessarily long, because you do have that increased material. That's why you don't see a lot of just totally flat edged blades anymore. A lot of them have a curvature to them. Maybe like a boning knife has a very straight blade to it without any kind of belly. And you're going to see a steel or a blade like that dull out much quicker than you would something with that curvature. So the curve to the blade is kind of, even on daily carry knives, something that you're not using heavily on tough hide or meat or cartilage. That's going to be kind of the way that most manufacturers go these days. Any knife designer is going to put that curvature in the blade for the most part.
I noticed looking at the hunt line, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but at least what I think I saw on the site was that All of the blades in the hunt line are either a drop point or a clip point. So why those two, and then help us understand the differences and performance of those two shapes.
Sure. So the drop point and clip point are just, they're very traditional designs. They've been around for a long time. A lot of people are probably familiar with like the Buck 110 folder that your dad or grandpa's got sitting in his sock drawer somewhere. That clip point is a very protrusive point that almost flares upward. And so when you're in those tight areas, I like to do the gutless method a lot of the time. And so when I'm kind of swinging blind on the tenderloin and pushing that intestine and belly downward to keep from puncturing it, something like that clip point can pose a little bit more of a risk in puncture than you would something like a drop point, where that point is almost angled somewhat downward or straight out. And again, it's getting back to control and precision of the cut. And so that drop point tip is going to allow you to get into tight areas, work very articulately without running the risk of puncturing something or cutting through hide that you don't want to. That clip point is going to be something that you can just kind of fly through a lot of material with without worrying about, you may not even be close to something like the intestine or gut at that point and be able to just kind of hack away at it and get the job done.
So we have size considerations and shape, and we've talked steels. What else goes into selecting a model beyond obviously personal preference, but I'm assuming it'd be things like handle materials, maybe some other features like gut hooks. What else is there to consider maybe when looking at the Benchmade lineup or lineups from other manufacturers and selecting a hunting knife?
Yeah, you're spot on. It's going to boil down on a fixed blade. It's going to get down to something like a gut hook, options like a gut hook, and handle material. So some people don't mind slicker feeling materials like wood or G10. We use a lot of G10 here. And G10 had originated as like an aerospace material. You saw it used on fuse boxes for a long time. It's highly temperature and chemical resistant. So it's an absolutely durable material, but it does have a slicker texture to it depending on how it's finished. So you compound that with a wet environment or blood, and that handle becomes very slippery. So we use on certain models a Santoprene. It's just a kind of fancy word for rubber. And that'll provide that grip and that flex for your hand that you're able to comfortably control and grasp that blade with and not run the risk of slipping out. Personally, I don't really have too much of an issue with the wood handles or the G10. I like the durability of them. Naturally, you will see something like Santoprene wear out over time if you're very tough on it. And it is a little bit more porous. So you could see buildup of color, grime on it. Some people are all about the aesthetic of their knife. I feel like these things are a tool and they're meant to be used. So I'm not too concerned with the way it looks so long as it's not rusting out on me. And it's, again, you're kind of boiling down handle material to personal preference there. I don't use any gut hooks myself. I know a lot of people that do. You see it even in our folding model, the Grizzly Creek. That knife itself is a folding blade meant to skin and dress animal, but we took the gut hook off of the blade itself and kind of stashed it away in the handle, almost like a Swiss Army knife. The feature folds out of the handle itself, so it's on demand. And I feel like I use that gut hook to cut rope and clamshell packaging more than I do on an animal itself.
Yeah, it's certainly handy for rope. That's how I've used it most.
Yeah, I used to have a Gerber knife that had a gut hook on it, and I could never get the thing sharp. It was such a small little hook that I tried different files and stuff like that. What's your guys' process on sharpening those?
It's just ceramic rod is the best thing I could recommend on them. If you can find one that essentially matches the diameter of the curvature of that hook itself, it can be tough to do, but you don't want to go at it with a lot of pressure. That steel has rolled on a microscopic level, and so you want to lightly scoop and correct that roll of steel back out so you have that perfectly sharp edge. I'm awful at it too. It's a tough thing to do sometimes, but anytime you send your knife in here, those guys will touch that thing up for you and kind of get it back to being as sharp as it was when it left the factory the first time.
Nice.
Cool. So we've mentioned some throughout, but just go ahead and give us more information on any specific models that you think we should check out, whether that's the most popular options in the hunt line or something new Just help us understand what you guys have to offer in the hunt line with Benchmade.
Sure. So one of the unique models that a lot of people overlook is our cleaver. It's the Nestucca cleaver. I think it's a model 15100-1. It's got bright orange G10 handles, and it's kind of our take on an Alaskan Ulu. So I've used it on everything from processing salmon and steelhead to just skinning out whitetail. And that thing has far exceeded my expectations. It's heavy. So it's not something that I'm going to throw in the pack on a long trip into the backcountry. And I made the mistake of cleaning it in the kitchen one day. So my lady found it, and she now uses it to chop and dice vegetables in the kitchen more than anything. But that knife is great. I've really enjoyed using it. It's nice wide grip. If you guys have ever used an Ulu, it's incredibly easy to hang your deer up, pull that skin down, and just get that thing unzipped and stripped out as quickly as possible without exposing your hands or fingers to the blade itself. That guy's super cool. I like the Bug Out. It's not in our hunt line. It's just a standard daily carry folding knife. That's what I carry on the majority of my backcountry hunts. The thing weighs 2 ounces, and it performs like any other folding knife I've ever had. So super lightweight. You've got that S30V blade steel on it that we've talked about. The axis lock bar that we use on it is titanium, so it still holds that minimum of 800 pounds of pressure on the lock before that lock's going to fail and disengage. So in short, you're gonna shatter your blade before you ever get that lock to shut down on you.
Yeah, that's one I have my eye on for sure. Being 2 ounces, having that high quality steel, it seems like a great little package.
It is. And early season, I'm wearing super light pants, so I don't want a big clunky knife clapping around on my leg as I'm running up and down the mountains. And that the Bug Out, you barely know that it's there. But when it is time to use it, you don't feel like you've shorted yourself whatsoever on capability of that knife and design.
You mentioned the Altitude previously, the one that has the S90V, and it's obviously different. If you go look at it, it is basically just a skeleton frame of a knife. What are things to consider when looking at something like that? I mean, clearly it's lightweight, but, you know, not having the traditional handle, traditional, surround really to work with.
Mm-hmm.
What should one consider? I see that it has jimping like high and low and front and back. I mean, is it still going to provide good grip?
Yeah, it's think of it like a scalpel. It's not something that you're going to get a caveman grip on ever and be comfortable with. You're essentially coming down over the top of that knife, pinching those two carbon fiber handle scales with your thumb and your middle finger, and I walk my index finger out towards the tip there. So I'm really not grabbing much of the handle itself at all, and it just gives you phenomenal dexterity as you make your cuts. So as I used and tested that knife this past year, I was like, I'm just going to push this thing to its limits. We're testing it. I want to see what this thing is capable of. So I broke down my entire bowl with only that knife. And I mean, even getting down around ball joints in the hips, out to caping out the front shoulder and up to the face, it was absolutely incredible. We kind of created this perfect storm of the steel itself partnered with the angles of the bevel of the knife. And that thing just holds an edge longer than any knife I've ever used out of our lineup. It's pretty impressive. And it's something that, although we designed it for the minimalist, lightweight, kind of backcountry bow hunter type of guy, that's something that anybody could use hunting whitetail. I've seen guys use it on turkey. It's a very versatile knife, and it's one that will absolutely get you through your season without having to send it back to us here in Oregon and wait for Life Sharp and stuff like that. So,
crazy hypothetical I just thought of. Let's say you have a bull elk, and in one scenario, you're on a backpack hunt. You have only packed one knife because you want to have one knife to do it all, and weight's a concern.
Mm-hmm.
What would you choose there? And then if you had a totally different scenario, say it wasn't a backcountry hunt and you didn't have this pack list limitation,
yeah,
but you're breaking down the same elk, would you choose multiple knives? Would you just still continue to have one to get the job done? And if you were to choose multiple knives, why? Like, would it be one for skinning versus another for deboning? Just help us understand like this do-it-all mentality versus sure. something a bit more specialized for the task?
Definitely. So for that kind of long backcountry bow hunt where you're counting ounces on the pack, the altitude's going to be my knife of choice. I did it with a knife last year a couple times, and never once did I feel like I sold myself short. In terms of, I hunt the coast a lot here in Oregon, so it's not necessarily backcountry. You kind of park the rig in the morning and hike or ride your mountain bike around for 10, 12 miles, depending on the terrain there. And so that's something that I have a little bit more luxury of carrying one or two knives on me. And in that regards, I'm going to do a skinning knife, something like our Saddle Mountain Skinner that's got a big belly to it that I can use for unzipping that animal, processing through those shoulders and hindquarters. And then when it comes down to butchering, I'm going to look for something with just a little bit less of a belly than that Saddle Mountain Skinner, something like the Steep Country. It's got the bright orange Santoprene handle and a very high bevel grind on it. So it's great for slicing. Those would be the two that I would carry in that regards. And at the end of the day, you could get away with one or the other if you really wanted to. But having the luxury of having those two different specialized designs can really make that process very easy for you if you're not concerned about weight in the pack.
Is there anything else we didn't cover? I feel like we made some good ground, but are we forgetting something here?
Did we hit plain edge versus serrated?
Ah, good question.
Plain edge versus serrated. It's a super popular question. It's I hate to keep harping on the same answer, but it's personal preference. I completely steer clear of serrations myself because I'm awful at sharpening them. I think a lot of people are kind of in that same boat. So I feel like a well-sharpened fine-edged knife should be able to do just about everything a serrated blade can. You do see improved characteristics for serrated blades when it comes down to cutting something like rope or corrugated cardboard. You can preserve your fine edge portion of that blade by concentrating that heavy kind of beater work to the serrations themselves, and you chew at those guys. I don't really ever use them for dressing or skinning animals. Some people swear by them, but a lot of us here at the office that hunt pretty heavy are running exclusively fine edge blades, and that's part of why you don't see any serrated knives offered in our hunt line. You've got a well-sharpened blade that's going to hold an edge for a while. You shouldn't really have to worry about a knife with serrations at that point.
Good info.
Awesome. Troy, if guys are looking at the lineup and have questions, what's the best way to get more information? Is it to give you guys a call, shoot you an email, help us understand the resources on if guys have questions between different models on the line?
Definitely. We do have a very comprehensive catalog that's available on our website. You can download that in PDF if you want it. We do that annually. And then we've got a whole slew of incredibly knowledgeable people here in our customer service department. Those guys are available by phone Monday through Friday. So if you have questions, they've got a handful of guys up there that are more than happy to talk with you about your specific needs and applications and maybe explain some of the higher level terminology that we've got for our knives and product there. You can shoot us an email. Naturally, in this day and age, we get a lot of emails, so they keep the responses pretty tight, but you're definitely going to get an immediate answer if you're there sitting on your computer. Give us a buzz on the phone, and those people will be able to hammer out that conversation with you and kind of get you on the path that will suit your needs and keep you safe and comfortable in the field.
Perfect. Troy, man, thanks for joining us. This has been great.
Anytime, guys. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Well, guys, thanks as always for tuning in. We are glad to be back and releasing these things for you guys. Again, as always, if you have questions, suggestions, comments, a show you want to see in the future, definitely let us know. Send us an email to podcast@exomountaingear.com.